The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 149 of The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world, with me, Andy Zaltzman, here in London, in the last ever week in which we have a royal family before the revolution breaks out next week in preemptive protest at the hideous nuptials ahead between two confirmed Satan worshippers. And in New York City, it's John Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. Andy, last Friday, we played basketball after work, and it was the first game of competitive basketball I'd played since I was 12 years old, and you know that was in England, yep. Where I think it's fair to say that we're not professors of the sweet science of b-ball.
Speak for yourself.
I know that you have game, Andy. Yeah. I know you like to drive the paint and drive it hard. I was also under the impression that basketball, Andy, was at least 80% trash talk. So that's really all I'd prepared for. Lots of, not in my house, not up in here, and plenty of, all day, son, all day. But I tell you what turned out to be a great strategy for me, Andy, was basically spending the entire game standing on the perimeter shooting outside shots, and then, with the game-winning shot on the line, suddenly driving to the basket for the first time, managing to take everyone by complete surprise and ending the game with an uncontested layup, to the joy of myself and the genuine disgust of everyone else, including all my own team. Game winner, Andy! I posterised them!
You posterised them, John.
Where are my now signature brand trainers?
So this is Bugle 149 for the week beginning Monday, the 18th of April, 2011. 149, of course, the highest score ever recorded in a professional football match. This is a true story.
What?
It came between AS Adema and Stade Olympique de Lemion Antananarivo in the Madagascan League in 2002. And it finished Adema 149, Stade Olympique 0. And Adema clinched the Madagascan title. Quite a convincing scoreline.
Yeah.
149-0. What happened was, the Stade Olympique felt they'd been hard done by the referee in their previous game that had knocked them out of contention. And they decided to throw a full 90-minute 11-man tantrum and spent the entire game getting the ball from the kickoff, running towards their own goal and kicking it in their own goal. 149 deliberate own goals.
Yeah, that's a commitment to a tantrum as well. You think after like 80 own goals, you'd get bored.
When some teams would have stopped even after one, or after five. Others would have thought they'd made their points after maybe 10 minutes of hammering the ball past their own goalkeeper, but not Stade Olympique de Lemion. They kept it up for 90 f***ing minutes. They'd probably still be there now if the final whistle hadn't gone. It was a bit like continuing to protest against the Vietnam War now, or marching around London shouting Thatcher out, or churning yourself to the railings outside the Ministry of Defence, complaining about the government selling muskets to the dodgy Prussian regime. They really overmade that point. But there are some important questions arising from this, John. Firstly, what was said in both teams' half-time team talks? And did the manager of Stade Olympique come out in the post-match interview after seeing his team score 149 own goals and say, there's a lot of positives we can take away from this? And also, bearing in mind no one on the winning team would touch the ball, who won man of the match? I mean, that had to be a tough call for whoever was commentating that day. And it could have been worse, John, because I guess we have to assume that the referee did not add any extra time, any added time. You're supposed to add, I think, 30 seconds per goal. So with the goals being scored at roughly 1 per 36 seconds, he should have been adding an extra 37 minutes per half. Now, of course, in those 37 minutes, another 61 goals would have been scored, necessitating another 30 and a half minutes of stoppage time, in which 50 more goals would have been scored, and so on and so on, until if he'd applied the letter of the law and kept adding 30 more seconds each time a goal was scored, each half would have lasted 4 hours and contained 397 goals. Resulting in a final score of 749-0 and a finishing time, assuming it was an evening kickoff, of around about 3:30 in the morning.
Well, time well spent, Andy.
The ref let himself down, John. He let himself down. And he let football down. This is for the week beginning Monday, the 18th of April, and that means it is 81 years since the 18th of April 1930, a day on which the BBC announced that there was no news. That was the official BBC news bulletin that day. They simply said, there is no news. What a day that must have. I think that's the last day there was ever no news at all. I don't know if there was sports news. I hope, and there must have been some sport. And that never stops. We cannot afford to let sports stop. That's the only thing stopping us noticing the real news. And 15th of April, as we record, which means that it is now 146 years to the day since Abraham Lincoln woke up in the morning, checked his diary, found that all that was written in it was pop clogs, looked angrily at his secretary and said, did you book this in without telling me, and died. And it's also the 500th anniversary of the invention of the first ever board game, the classic 1511 issue, Collect the Queens, a favourite of King Henry VIII himself. Arguably got a bit too into it. It was fine until one of his hunting dogs ate it in 1533, by which time the company making it had gone out of business after unsuccessful launches of other titles, including Playground, Playgrounds, Witchdaft, Gout and About, Cholera or Bust, Hunt the Heretic, and Burning Bernard's Super Stakeout. Henry had become addicted to the game by this stage, and without the outlets of the board game, which he'd often play for days at a stretch without coming out of his bedroom, it inevitably influenced the way that he behaved in everyday life, and the rest, of course, is head-chopping history. Has humanity learnt its lessons? Has it f***ed John? As Mother Teresa herself used to say.
Top story this week, Middle East update, the Forgotten Countries! Andy, the international news has been dominated by Libya all this week due to the fact that we, as NATO, have been trying to bomb some freedom into it. And it's been all Gaddafi said this, Gaddafi said that, Gaddafi did this to his civilian population with that. And it's all definitely newsworthy, no one's denying that. It's just that there are other countries in the Middle East that we're not giving our physical or indeed mental attention to that are also deserving of being discussed. What about the plucky countries that no one's really talking about? The forgotten Middle East, if you will. Your Israels, your Syrias, your United Arab Emirates. What are those crazy little bastards up to? Well, let's take a look. Israel! Jews news! Israel is currently spending its days shitting itself at the moment over the situation all around it, which is not very different at all from how it's been spending its last half a century. But there was even more instability than usual coming out of the, oh, come on, you promised, land this week. Justin Bieber, the floppy-haired, asexual object of affection for teenage girls around the world, was visiting Israel this week and unwittingly stumbled into something of a diplomatic snafu. He was scheduled to have a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, but it was called off at the last minute, with both sides differing on why. Now, before we delve much further into this story, Andy, let's not gloss over what's a very important fact. Let's not bury the lead here, which is that before it was cancelled, Benjamin Netanyahu was scheduled to have a meeting with Justin Bieber. We all live in a world where that nearly happened. Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, very nearly had a meeting with Justin Bieber, 17-year-old singer boy. Is this how far from a peace agreement we now are? We're just throwing Bieber at the wall. Hoping he sticks.
Well, I mean, it's not, it's not. I mean, that's not so new, is it? I mean, let's not forget that Golda Meir had a meeting with Donny Osmond in the early 70s. But to be fair to him, John, he's not the first young heartthrob in the Holy Land to endure a mixture of public adulation and official interference. But let's just hope he has a more effective legal team than some of his more illustrious predecessors. Of course, I don't know much about Justin Bieber, John. He's just a name to me. Mm-hmm. I have to look him up on Wikipedia, famous for hits such as Baby and the follow-up single Toddler. And if you play his hit single Baby backwards, it quite explicitly states that Justin Bieber will only date committed and certifiable Zionists, that he has a tattoo of Ariel Sharon on his back, and that he thinks Israel should extend their settlement program into other areas, including Jordan, Turkey and Iowa. Although whether he knew that when he was singing it, or if he was just stitched up by my people, who of course run the entire entertainment industry, we don't know. We've got it stitched up, John. As proved by my unending run of success in primetime British television.
You are a one-man argument against anti-Semitism, Andy. A spokesman for Benjamin Netanyahu said that he'd been approached with the idea of a meeting and that the Prime Minister had been, I quote, open to that. See, straight away, that is surprising, Andy. I'd have thought that if someone asked the Prime Minister of a major country located in one of the most violent flashpoints on the planet whether he wanted to meet Justin Bieber, he would be closed to that. Or at the very least, his instinctive question would be, why? Why exactly would I do that? I have a lot to do with my day. Apparently, the Prime Minister's office suggested including children from communities in southern Israel that have been under intense rocket fire from Gaza in recent days. But the spokesman said that proved impossible because Bieber's representatives had turned down the idea of including the children. Wow. So the special Bieber summit was scuppered over the situation in Gaza. I guess that isn't much of a surprise, Andy, when you think about it. So many of Justin Bieber's lyrics are based around the current affairs in Gaza and the West Bank. You've talked about what it's like when you play it backwards. Never mind that, Andy. Look at what it's like when you play it forwards. Look at that hit, baby. If you just imagine that the subject of the song is Gaza and the Palestinian territories, it's clearly a song trying to win that land back. Here's how it goes. You know you love me. I know you care. Just shout whenever, and I'll be there. You are my love. You are my heart. And we will never, ever, ever be apart. That clearly speaks to the determination of hardline Israelis' complete refusal to agree to a two-state solution. Bieber doesn't stop there, Andy. He goes on, saying, are we an item? Girl, substitute that for Gaza, quit playing. We're just friends. What are you saying? Said, there's another, and looked right in the eyes. My first love broke my heart for the first time. Now, that's a little poetic license from Bieber there, Andy. I don't think he's suggesting by any means that this is the first time the Jewish people in their history have had their hearts broken. But he continues saying, and I was like, baby, oh, I thought you'd always be mine. Why did he think that, Andy? Why was he so sure? Because the land was promised to Moses, Andy. That's what Bieber cannot get his head around in the plaintive chorus of that song. It's all there.
In another Twitter message, Bieber wrote, I want to see this country and all the places I've dreamed of, and mm-hmm. whether it's the Paps or being pulled into politics, it's been frustrating. And he was quoting there directly from George W. Bush on a visit to Iraq in 2003. And Bieber might have a postgraduate diploma in brushing his hair, but he could not punctuate his way out of a wet paper bag, John. There was a frankly distressing lack of commas. Not to mention the apostrophes that should be there. I mean, he's at least three apostrophes down. It's an absolute f***ing disgrace. I would f***ing nail him up if I had the chance.
This just
crucify
show,
Bieber. It's got to be done.
Well, there's a hashtag for Twitter. This just goes to show how crazy pop singers get, Andy. With all that adulation, all those fans, your ego is inflated to the extent that even as a 17-year-old boy, you find yourself watching the news on CNN and thinking, well, the Middle East has been in turmoil for thousands of years now, and there just seems no hope of a solution on the horizon. What can I do? What can I, Justin Bieber, do? What can I, 17-year-old Canadian singer boy Justin Bieber, do to not only help but solve this intractable problem forever? Sure, I could keep singing and dancing and releasing hit albums, or I, Justin Bieber, could get the Prime Minister of Israel on the phone and enter into direct negotiations myself. You know what? I'm going to do it. And also, you know what? I hope he's successful, Andy. I hope that Justin Bieber can bring peace to that region. Would I be surprised? Yes. But would I be happy? Tremendously. Plus, here's the thing. It could actually work. And here's how. If either Netanyahu or Abbas have 12-year-old daughters, Because there is no greater weak point for any father than when it comes to doing something for their daughters. And if Bieber can somehow leverage the affection Netanyahu and Abbas have for their little girls, I think he could get them to make major concessions on both sides and there could actually be genuine peace. Well, I'd love to come and do a private concert for you and your friends, but only if you can convince Daddy to allow Jerusalem to be governed by a third party. In other Jews news, Israel's foreign minister is in trouble. Firstly, because during a radio interview when discussing Hamas, he apparently flushed the toilet live on air. Let's just play a quick clip of it now. Wow. Andy, I mean, you got to hand it to him. That's pretty incredible.
Well, let he who has never flushed a toilet live on air whilst talking about an extremely delicate political situation cast off the first stone.
It's such an easy mistake to make. He's got into real trouble, as many people have argued that his behaviour was grossly offensive. But I actually think this should be encouraged. I think much more politicians should do interviews from the can. Many people do much of their best thinking from there, and it seems only fitting that it be a place that you address your nation from. Think of how a well-placed toilet flush could have provided an unforgettable piece of punctuation to many great radio addresses. Just imagine how great it would have been if Chamberlain had announced that he declared war on Germany in 1939 by saying over the radio, "I am speaking to you from the bathroom of 10 Downing Street." This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland. A state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received and that consequently, this country is at war with Germany.
I have in my hand another piece of paper.
What I'm saying is, good luck, Bieber. You've got your work cut out for you. Syria news now. And Israel is currently watching the unrest in its northern neighbour Syria with justified concern.
John, come on, you've surely missed a chance to launch with the headline,
that?
You cannot be Syria.
I did miss that
you
chance.
Missed that,
yeah. Oh, well, did I
slack.
Miss it?
That's slack,
or did
that
I refuse to take
slack.
That chance?
I don't know which Israel would be worse.
Israel's Deputy Prime Minister, Dan Meridor, gave my favourite quote of the week when he said not only that the situation with Syria is complex, but also that, I quote, "We are not in the business of telling other countries how to rule themselves." That's what he said, Andy. That is what he said. Not in the business of telling other countries how to rule themselves. I would argue that Israel was very, very much in that business. I'm not saying they're the CEO, Andy. I think that position is still held by America. But they are definitely on the board.
Oh, no, it depends what you say, you know, telling other countries how to do it. What does that mean, John? You know, giving them a powerful hint is very different to actually telling them, you know. Invading them as by way of a nudge, that is not the same as telling them outright, John. I think you're taking a very strong anti-Israel line in this podcast, John. Syria currently scores 67% on the Economist magazine's Unrest Index, which is quite an entertaining index if you're into indexes. Anything over 60% is technically known as a maximum huff. And to put it in context, France in 1789 scored 100%, and Scandinavia scores 1%. They got it all out of their system 1,000-odd years ago. Now, to give further context, me personally, when I've made a mozzarella and tomato salad and I realise I haven't got any fresh basil, 56% unrest. John, when his trailer on his film set isn't painted the right shade of red, doesn't have an exact replica of Marlon Brando's favourite swivel chair in it, or doesn't contain at least two members of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, he's up to 85%.
Well, what are contracts for, Andy, if they're not observed?
Just, they're getting on a bit now, John. You've got to accept that they can't always get two of them there.
Then don't agree to having them in there! the situation in Syria has been deteriorating over the last week and over the last month, which is extra concerning, seeing as the West is planning on doing absolutely nothing about it. About 200 people have died in weeks of protest against repression by President Bashar al-Assad's government. And what's the response been, other than everyone changing the channel on the TV? Well, the US said that the use of force against the protesters in Syria was outrageous and expressed concern about claims that the wounded were being denied medical care, saying the United States strongly condemns the continued efforts to suppress peaceful protesters. And if that statement, backed up by absolutely nothing, did not have the Syrian authorities quaking in their boots, then the British government weighed in on Tuesday, warning Britons not to travel to Syria unless absolutely necessary. Wow. We are withholding our tourists, Andy. Take that, the system. We are really taking this seriously now.
So what Neville Chamberlain said back in... Same thing. Carried on. Please call off your holidays to Munich until further notice. President Assad does seem to have polarised the nation like a man painting a bear head to toe in Tippex. And, thanks, I'm here all week. and protesters have been demanding greater political freedom, an end to corruption, action on poverty, and an end to the state of emergency that has been in place for decades. Now, this all sounds drearily familiar, John. When are these rebels going to come up with something original, John? This is why we're not taking any interest. We've heard it all before. It's the same song over and over again. I want them to be protesting about something different. I just can't get an angle on it, John. I cannot get an angle on it.
President Assad made his first public appearance in front of Parliament since protests began, without giving any timetable for reform. So, you know, that's reassuring for the protesters. He's basically saying, trust me, I've got this. Have I ever given you a reason to doubt me in the past? Raise your hands if you can think of a single time. OK, officers, please take those people away. He's insisted that promised reforms are not being made under pressure, but that had been decided in principle back in 2005 and delayed for a variety of compelling reasons, including the need to meet people's daily needs. See? He's been thinking about this for years, Andy. He's actually moving towards reforms much faster than anyone thinks. He's 6 years ahead of whatever the protesters want. So they can all just give up and go the f*** home. He can take it from here.
An eminent defence lawyer, Mohanad Al-Hassani, is in jail currently for spreading false information. I do hope neither of us ever goes to Syria, John. That could be big trouble. Yeah. And also for weakening national morale. Which is, that, I mean, if you're going to start jailing people for that, John, I mean, that is very bad news for top-level sportsmen, John. I mean, when you're looking at the entire England football team being jailed every 2 years, you can't run a nation like that. Dubai news now, and the UAE have arrested three political activists who called for, wait for it, democratic and economic reforms. Mr. Mansour was arrested in Dubai after he signed a petition in favour of an elected parliament, which is pretty f***ing radical when you think about it. And, as you know, I went to Dubai a couple of months ago, and it is a stunning place, but underneath that stunning exterior, as we've discussed, there is... It is slightly less stunning, and the more you hear about it... It's like when you meet a really beautiful woman, John. I'd put it to you this way, and you get chatting, you hit it off, and you think, this is really too good to be true, and then, sure enough, you go back to her room, and it turns out she is Donald Rumsfeld. very much like that.
Happens.
With Dubai.
So, it happens, Andy.
So we'll keep tabs on it. We'll keep tabs on it. More hideous leaders' corruption news now, and the Czech president, Václav Klaus, has really trumped anything that Ben Ali or Mubarak could do, John, because he has stolen a ceremonial pen on a state visit to Chile.
Shame on you!
Shame on you,
For
Klaus.
Shame!
Klaus, the great-grandson of the prominent Czech philanthropist Santa Klaus, was seen surreptitiously... sneaking the pen under the desk. And he had a look on his face, a kind of grin sweeping across his mouth. That very much said, my life is going even better than I ever thought it could.
It was caught on video, and it's on YouTube at the moment. It's attracted, last time I checked, 3.5 million views. And if you are looking for something to watch on the internet today, just to temporarily lift your spirits, please consider taking 60 seconds and going to YouTube and watching it. It is without doubt the happy, guilty look that spreads across his face at the end that makes it all worthwhile. As you say, it's an expression that I think can only communicate one thing, and that one thing is, I've just stolen a pen.
Well, it's a fundamental rule of the human condition, John, that you and I know only too well from various recording studios. Is it? No matter how rich, famous, or successful or important the person becomes, they will always, always keep an eye out for a free pen. That is as basic as breathing, as far as I'm concerned.
A Chilean spokesperson said the president's guests were absolutely free to take the pens, and Klaus himself said he frequently helps himself to such objects, saying it's what people do regularly. They keep notepads and pens from such events. Uh-huh. And what else do you assume they give you, Mr. Klaus? Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can take the notepads and the pens and the chairs, no problem. Everyone does it. I just bring the car around the back. Sometimes I take the microphones as well. And the flags on the stage. Sometimes the stage too. Just to add to my collection. It's not a problem. Everyone does it.
That's all. Ben Ali was just helping himself to some commemorative gold that happened to be lying around.
A Czech spokesman as well said, it's not the first time that Klaus has held an expensive pen. At his swearing-in for his second presidential term in 2008, he was presented with an 18-carat gold pen worth around $60,000. The spokesperson went on to say, look, I even have it here. Then checked his pockets as the blood drained from his face and muttered, oh, for f*** sake, Klaus!
Bugle feature section and art. Question for you. How do you tell the difference between a work of art and a 70-metre-high penis? Answer, don't bother. They're the same. As has recently been discovered in St. Petersburg. The radical art collective Voyna has won an award sponsored by the Russian Ministry of Culture for their 210-foot penis painted on a bridge in St. Petersburg. That gives hope to us all, John. It's an inspiring story.
That's great stuff.
Great work of art. I mean, it's a terrific work of art. I say it's up there with the very best, it's basically how Michelangelo started, drawing, just scrawling cocks and balls all over buildings. You know, he made a pretty solid career out of it in the end.
Apparently that's how he started all of his sculptures as well. He'd always start by just, chiselling a penis out of a piece of marble, and then... sometimes would decide to chisel a man around it. Yeah,
just to make it look better. He always got caught when he did it at school, though, with his graffiti cock and balls, because they were just so much more realistic than the other boys. And you also have to ask, after this art prize, what does it really mean, this 210-foot penis on a bridge pointing at the headquarters of the FSB Secret Service? I mean, what is the subtext there, John? Uh-huh. I mean, I guess, like all great works of art, it can be interpreted in innumerable different ways. You know, perhaps Voyna were inferring that the FSB is a bit of a penis. Perhaps they're in fact massive fans of the FSB, and the bridge tool was merely a fertility symbol to help the Secret Service personnel breed more effectively. Perhaps they're even attempting to convey through the medium of the architecto cock the notion that the FSB is a fundamental part of the regeneration of Russian society, and that if it is attacked politically, it would be a real punch in the national nuts. So we don't know, John. I mean, it's just simplistic to say it's just a cock on a bridge. And also, what about the kids, John, who, as we discussed in considerable length in Bugle 69, now widely regarded as a classic of drawing massive wangs on roofs comedy, the kid who drew a massive wang on his parents' roof, I mean, did he know that he was, in fact, painting an artistic masterpiece, John? Does that put that achievement in a different perspective?
I think it's when you're an artist of that caliber, Andy, you're just doing it for yourself. It's just self-expression, and there's no right answer with how you interpret a massive penis on a bridge or roof. Now, we actually covered this story of the Russians painting a penis on a bridge when it first happened, but I have to say that I did think at the time that the only award they'd receive would be the one that I gave them in my head. And they do have some previous, this artistic...
What was that award, John? Are you going to give that award a name?
Greatest Penis on a Bridge. Greatest Penis on a Bridge 2010.
Right. Yeah, fair call.
Yeah, the, The art group, they were prosecuted for fomenting ethnic and religious hatred by staging an exhibit that scandalised the Russian Orthodox Church. And they infiltrated the courtroom during that hearing with electric guitars and an amplifier and apparently suddenly climbed up onto the benches to perform a punk song called All Cops Are Bastards. So that is always a good way to sway the judge over to your side of thinking. Oh, these are entirely rational artists. I'm sure they haven't done anything wrong.
In other art news, the Chris Akabusi Memorial Gallery in New York is to exhibit a number of lost works by former world number one ranked sculptor Auguste the Chisel Master Rodin. These works are mostly done in the early 20th century, and they include classics such as The Man Who Slammed His Finger in a Door, The Woman with the Unignorable Bit of Lettuce on Her Cheek, and Victor Hugo Does an Underarm Squelchy. In other arts news, EA Arts, the makers of computer games, have produced Fresco Frenzy, a new PlayStation game based on the life of 14th century Italian painting whiz Giotto. You have to complete a landmark series of frescoes in a chapel, whilst aliens fire rockets at your head and a hedgehog tries to steal your easel. This complements their hit Gallery Manager 2011 release, in which you have to curate and market successful exhibitions in fringe art galleries.
Your emails now, and, well, we have an absolutely fantastic email from Name Withheld by Request. And it says, under the subject, how funny is the Bugle? It says, dear gents, I imagine that in future generations, scholars will debate the highly important question of how funny was the Bugle. To help them in that quest, I have a definitive data point to add to their body of knowledge. The Bugle is not, capitalised, funny enough to distract a man from the trauma of his own vasectomy. At this point, Andy, this email had my full undivided attention. Last summer, Name Withheld goes on to say, having reached the ripe old age of 35 and sired two reasonably acceptable children, I was notified by my wife that it was time to pull the plug on my reproductive prowess. And so it was that I found myself lying awkwardly on an examining table in suburban Philadelphia while a nice doctor laid out a series of Braveheart-esque instruments that would momentarily be applied to my exposed wedding tackle. Having anticipated that this would be an unpleasant half an hour, I'd stocked my iPod chock full of Bugle episodes in the hope that I'd be able to distract myself with the comic stylings of Mr. Oliver and Zaltzman. This plan did not work. Let's just say that any time a doctor points a needle at your most tender portions and says, you're going to feel a little sting, you're going to need something a lot stronger than the Bugle. I tried to bury myself in the Bugle, but to no avail. It was the longest 30 minutes of my life, and the Bugle provided zero relief whatsoever. I'm sorry to report. So there you go. I'm sorry to have to let you know that the Bugle isn't funny enough to distract a man from his vasectomy, but perhaps you'll find solace in the fact that your humble podcast has been listened to during such an intimate moment in a man's life. Well, thank you very much, not only for that email, but through allowing us to share that nightmarish experience with you.
Was it the... I can only assume it wasn't the Lou Reed dog puns episode, because I'm sure that would have been... That would have worked.
I feel a bit sick.
That I've got to say, you know, we've talked in the past about how the Bugle is listened to in quite odd places. Either people in labs pulling electrical equipment out of the wall, the South
Antarctica,
Pole...
Yep.
And,
Darfur.
Yeah, that, exactly, Darfur. During a vasectomy is right up there.
Maybe the problem was that the surgeon was doing the same. Sport now, and it's bullfighting season. And the star of the Spanish bullfighting season so far has been the brilliant and unorthodox young matador, Juan Fernando Beltrán, who fights under the nickname El Negociador. He's the first matador in history to attempt to reach an amicable agreement with the bull, which is acceptable to both sides. He reached another spectacular deal in the Pamplona Beef Dome last Saturday. As a capacity crowd bayed for compromise, El Negociador hammered out an agreement with the star local bull Corky Kebabhead, under which the bull would get to live out his days peacefully, giving rides to disadvantaged local children who'd run out of donkeys because, well, they do run out of donkeys in Spain because of, you know, gravity. And Beltran got, as his part of the deal, got first dibs on eating Corky's succulent young kids. After a half an hour of wrangling over the small print, Ilnegothiador triumphantly held up the contract with Corky's unmistakable hoof print signature on it, and the crowd went mild. Afterwards, Beltran said, "This is the 21st century. The modern audience wants to see a peaceful resolution, not blood in the arena. I was confident I could get Corky to sign up to my proposals. The only moment of doubt was when I said to him, 'You have to try to pacify the crowd.' He got horny. He thought I'd said pacify was in the crowd, the mythological Cretan lass who slept with a bull and gave birth to a minotaur. He thought it was his lucky day, but we had a good laugh about it afterwards, and then he went off to his favourite udder bar to celebrate." And in other sports news, it was my kids' charity fun run today. You might remember last year we tried to raise £700 million for the BBC Sport Relief campaign after my daughter ran five times round an obstacle course in her nursery school playground. Mm-hmm. And we fell a little disappointingly short of that that target by nearly £700 million. But we did raise a few thousand pounds. So she did it again this year, as did my son. An even longer obstacle course this year. It was sort of, you know, they added a bit extra to the course. It was very demanding. It was a formidable feat of athleticism that my daughter made it around. She got balked, sadly, at the first corner. Was never really in contention to win it, but... You know, it's although she's going to have to learn to live with the stigma of defeat. It's not really about that at this level. It's not really about that. And I did win the parents' race as well, with a masterful display. Hit the first corner.
Really?
Hit the first corner in front. It's not a course for overtaking, really. Bunched everyone up behind me and just cruised home. So, but anyway, I was hoping to be able to encourage you all to give 10 pence again, which is what we tried to do last year. 10 pence from every person in the world would have made £700 million. But I've just set up a Just Giving page, but the minimum donation is £2, which is frankly hugely disappointing.
Yeah.
But anyway, I've set it up. It's www.justgiving.com/hellobuglers. And we're raising money for Bliss, a charity for premature babies. So if you can see it in your heart to give £2, please do. And if not, I will investigate the options for donating pitifully small amounts, and I will update you next week.
I think you may have made that rule, Andy, after thousands of buglers gave 10p in online transactions last year. You may have been responsible for that minimum donation rule now. That, Andy, just correct me if I'm wrong, on the in terms of the new obstacles this year, was there or was there not a lake of fire?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a lake of fire, but, you know, it wasn't a particularly big one.
No, it was, okay. You know,
it was like the water jump at the Grand National. It was more for show than... You know, you don't actually see many horses drown in that anymore. You know, where's the thrill gone, John? So do support that. Justgiving.com/hellobuglers. And let's see if we can crack the... Well, in fact, I've lowered the target a bit more realistic this year. Just £600 million. £600 million is what we want to raise for Bliss for premature babies. So do support that, buglers. Until next week, goodbye.
Goodbye, buglers. Goodbye.